Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I'm your host, author, and journalist Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our second look at the Texas killing fields. Before we get going, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to help support the show, there's a couple ways you can do this. First, you can go to your favorite podcast app, subscribe to the show, and leave a 5-star review. You can also go to tinyurl.com/decastpatreon, where for as little as $1.99 a month, you can get access to early ad-free shows and exclusive content, just as my first two Patreon members, Channel and Anthony, did, as have my largest Patreon contributors monthly, Debbie, Samantha, Betty, and Matt. They all went to tinyurl.com/decastpatreon. Alright, now that all of that is out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair, kick back and relax. If you're at work, I hope this helps you get through the day. I've got my coffee. I've got my cigarettes. Let's go in to the crypt. When we left off last week, there had been a series of disappearances over the summer and fall of 1971 in and around Galveston, Texas. Now, a number of bodies had been discovered in marshlands and fields north of the city that turned out to belong to these missing girls. Some of them were skeletonized. Others were found bound hand and foot. A number of them were found with their heads removed. But there's still a number of girls missing at this point as we move into 1972. Now, before we really get into moving forward with these cases, we're just going to do a brief recap of the missing girls who have vanished from the area up until this point. We have 13-year-old Colette Anise Wilson, who disappeared on June 17th, 1971, and was found on November 26th of 1971. We have Brenda K. Jones, who disappeared on July 1st, 1971, and was found the following day, July 2nd, 1971, in Galveston Bay. We have Rhonda Renee Johnson and Sharon Lynn Shaw, both age 14, who disappeared on August 4th, 1971. We had 19-year-old Gloria Ann Gonzalez, disappeared October 28th, 1971. Her body was found in the same area as Colette Wilson on November 23rd, 1971. 12-year-old Allison Ann Craven, who disappeared on November 9th, 1971. 15-year-olds Debbie Catherine Ackerman and Marie Talbot Johnson, who disappeared on November 15th, 1971, and whose bodies were discovered in Turner's Bayou on November 17th of 1971. So we've got a lot of missing girls. It's starting to get attention in the press around Galveston, but also statewide. I have read some reports that have even stated that some news stations in areas like Los Angeles and New York carried small pieces on these disappearances and body discoveries as well. Now, as 1972 dawns, we are going to continue looking at the disappearance of Sharon Shaw and Renee Johnson. If you'll recall, they went missing on August 4th after having spent the day in Galveston. An older friend of theirs was supposed to pick them up and drive them home. On January 3rd of 1972, two teenage boys were in rowboats going down a drainage ditch in Taylor Bayou. Now, Taylor Bayou is a swampy marsh area not far from State Highway 146 and Shore Acres, which is a coastal town across the Galveston Bay from Galveston. It is rather an upscale area. If you've ever seen a swamp, it's filled with grasses and trees and is fairly desolate looking, and if you've walked through them, they can also feel desolate and far removed from the rest of the world. Now, on this date of January 3rd, as these two boys are rowing, one of them spots what he thinks is a volleyball floating in the water. The boys quickly realize that it is not a volleyball, but is instead a human skull, marking the area with a broken oar from one of their boats. According to police documents, the boys rushed to one of the homes and informed their father that they had found this grisly discovery. However, as it was getting late in the afternoon, the father decided that their discovery could wait until the next morning. Following day, they search the area. The man finds the skull in the water, pulls it out into the boat, at which point they row back to their home, and the man contacts the police. The man had placed the skull in the garage where it wouldn't disturb his family and where it would be safe from curiosity from his son and his son's friend. Now, according to police records, the man had taken the time to wrap the skull inside of a blanket. Some may say, you know, he destroyed any possible evidence, but the reality is this skull had been in the water for a long period of time, and any evidence that may have been on it at any point had almost certainly long been washed away. Law enforcement descends on Taylor Bayou, mindful of the fact that other murder victims had been discovered in the area, and that the people in the Galveston-Houston area are really uneasy about all of these disappearances and murders. They start searching Taylor Bayou in earnest, hoping to discover anything else that might lead them to the identification of this particular victim. Police would later state that hurricanes which had occurred in the area earlier in the season had hampered their efforts, but had also likely washed away much of the remains. This necessitated the police to bring in heavy equipment like backhoes, bulldozers, sieves, along with cadaver dogs. This is eventually going to lead to a small amount of bones being discovered, mostly teeth, a section of a arm bone from the left arm, as well as a human sacrum, which is the triangular bone that sits at the base of the spine. Unfortunately, on January 12th, the medical examiner is going to release his findings stating that these bones belong to Rhonda Renee Johnson. Now, they list her official date of death as January 3rd, 1972. Reality is, more likely than not, Rhonda and Sharon died not long after being abducted. However, the police could not locate Sharon's remains. This, too, was chalked up to the fact that so many storms had ravaged the area, but there were some within law enforcement who suspected that it was possible that the killer had taken both victims, realized it was too difficult to control two young, feisty 14-year-olds at the same time, and had simply killed and discarded one of them along the way before taking Sharon off to do whatever it was that he wanted to do with her. Obviously, the police continue their search, widening the search area in an attempt to find more pieces of Renee, but also to see if they can locate anything that might indicate to them Sharon Shaw's fate. As one of the investigators later stated, quote, "We had sieves and we went through the mud looking for bones, anything we could find. We found some pieces of jewelry, things a young girl would wear. We fanned out walking the bayou, poking into the high grass, watching out for nests of snakes." After a few weeks, law enforcement gives up their search, believing that Sharon Shaw's remains are forever lost to them, as previously stated that hurricanes and other natural events had simply washed her body to an area where it would never be recovered. Now, this next part of the case has always been a little bit sketchy. After authorities officially give up the search, a man ends up coming across a pile of bones. This is on February 17th at roughly 5 p.m. A 20-year-old man was walking on the banks of the bayou when he locates something hiding in the high grass. Upon further investigation, the man discovers that it's a pile of human bones, at which point he marks it and runs off, heading to one of the nearby chemical plants that are currently being built in the area. Now, the reason why I say that this part has always been sketchy is that the police have, to the best of my knowledge, never released this man's name, nor have they ever been able to give a concrete reason why the man was out walking on the bayou at, you know, dusk. Some sources state that the man had heard about the searches and had decided to lend a hand. However, why he decided to do so after the search was officially ended is unknown. Other sources have it that he had been a local who was simply out for an evening stroll. While others still postulate the idea that this man may have, in fact, been responsible for the murders, or at least had some form of knowledge of them. It is not uncommon for a killer to go back to the scene of a crime after it has been committed, particularly if he knows it's an area that law enforcement have already checked and marked off as not containing any evidence. In any event, the police arrive on the scene, and what they discover is a nearly complete skeleton, along with a human skull which has been detached. On this human skull, they are going to find a golden crucifix wrapped around the jawbone, which is later going to be identified by Sharon Shaw's mother as belonging to her daughter. Obviously, this body is going to end up being identified as that of Sharon Shaw. The interesting thing with this is that, at least from everything I have been able to discover, this area where the man discovered this body had already been checked thoroughly by police, and for some reason, they completely overlooked this pile of bones. The saga of Renee and Sharon is not over, however. There's another piece of information that is rarely, if ever, talked about when discussing these cases. At some point during the September of 1971, a human torso was discovered in Taylor's Bayou in this same general vicinity. The torso was said to be handless, footless, and headless, and to be wearing a shirt from one of the local surf shops in Galveston that both Renee and Sharon were known to have frequented. The medical examiner would later conclude that this torso was that of a young boy and not of a woman, but the question remained as to whether or not this torso could in fact have belonged to Renee Johnson was so strong that decades later, the Galveston police would put in a request to have the torso looked at again in the possibility that the original medical examiner had made a mistake and that this torso was in fact that of a young girl. However, for whatever reason, the torso has since been misplaced or lost, and unfortunately, there is very little chance, unless it is magically discovered, of ever finding out, you know, concrete whether or not this torso belonged to a boy or a girl. But it is rather interesting that this torso was found wearing a shirt from a local business that both victims were known to have frequented in the exact same area that their remains would later be found. Now, with the discovery of Johnson and Shaw's remains, the public is up in arms. There's a lot of coverage of it in the local media, and law enforcement is strongly looking at all of these cases, seeing the similarities in many of them. Police end up going back out to Taylor Bayou, and they locate a set of keys. However, they're never able to link these keys to any one person. They also end up finding pieces of clothing that is later determined to have been similar to what Shaw and Johnson were last known to be wearing. In addition to this, thick black string was located in the general vicinity of the remains that was theorized to have been used to bind both Renee and Sharon's hands and feet, leading police to theorize that, much like some of the other victims, both of these girls had been bound in a similar fashion. So they have all of these victims, these former missing girls, many of whom have been discovered tied up, or the possibility they've been tied up, most of them found in water, and one fact that is never brought up, many of them found decapitated. Now, the idea that all of these victims would suffer the same form of animal predation to me is skeptical at best. Investigating these crimes, I've always felt that the decapitation was in fact part of the ritual for this killer, just as I've always felt that the tying up and bringing to a wetland area was also part of this ritual. Unfortunately, though, so much time passed before many of these victims were discovered, it's highly unlikely we'll ever know with certainty whether or not the decapitation was in fact a part of this. And I know that there are some cases where the victims were found fairly quickly with their heads still attached to the body. And it's my opinion that in those cases, such as 14-year-old Brenda K. Jones, Debbie Catherine Ackerman, and Marie Talbot Johnson, something occurred which caused the killer to get rid of their bodies before he was ready to. This happens quite often in cases of serial murder where the killer has an idea inside of their head of what it is that they want to do to their victim to live out this fantasy that is inside of their mind, and some outside force, you know, people coming over to where they are at, or cars passing by, any number of things, forces them to abandon the plan and simply get rid of the victim's body prior to carrying out their desires. And I do believe that that is the reason why all of these initial victims were not found to be in a similar state. Another question that is never really talked about in regards to these murders is the lack of physical evidence in regards to some form of sexual assault. I think it's almost an absolute certainty that the killer's motive was sexual in nature, but because so many of the victims were found in a skeletal state, they obviously cannot do the types of tests that would lead them to know whether or not the victim had been sexually assaulted. There's also the possibility, too, that in those cases where remains were found fairly intact, they simply either did not look into that particular avenue, instead focusing on trying to identify a manner of death, or they have this information and have simply not released it. Many of these crimes remain unsolved, and because of that, even to this day, you know, 50-some-odd years later, there is information that law enforcement will hold back, such as, you know, victims having been sexually assaulted, in the hopes that should they ever encounter the individual responsible for these murders, they will provide that information to law enforcement during a confession that will cinch it for law enforcement that we did it, we got it, this is our guy. Now, also in February, the partial remains of Allison Ann Craven, who was 12 years old, if you'll recall, she went missing on November 9th of 1971 from the Houston apartment that she lived in with her mother, were found. This was in a field that was not far from the family home, where hand bones, some teeth, and a partial arm bone was discovered. Now, February 25th of 1972, the rest of her skeleton ends up being found in a Pearland, Texas field, which was along I-45 and roughly 10 miles from the family's apartment. Now, some people have put her on the list of the 11 young women who were murdered in the early 1970s. Others have not. It should be noted at this point that a man was arrested and convicted for Allison's death. That is a man by the name of Henry Doyle Shufflin Jr., who at this point was a 22-year-old Vietnam veteran. He was also the son of a U.S. Air Force Master Sergeant and a neighbor of the Craven family. Shufflin ends up coming under police suspicion, and he eventually confesses on May 2nd, 1972. There are others of these murders that are going to end up being officially solved in the next few months, and we're going to look at them at this point, because three individuals are going to end up in prison for a number of these different crimes. The first one we're going to look at is actually a duo. The most well-known of this duo is a man by the name of Harry Andrew Lanham. Lanham was born in Genoa, Ohio in 1948. He was 24, 25 years old by this point in time that we're discussing, and was working as a tow truck driver in Houston, Texas, where he ends up meeting up with a Vietnam veteran by the name of Anthony Michael Tony Nopa Jr. In April of 1972, Harry Lanham is brought in for questioning by police for the murder of Linda Faye Sutherland in Pearland, Texas. Sutherland's body had been discovered the prior November, right around the time that Debbie Ackerman and Marie Johnson went missing and were subsequently found murdered. Linda Faye Sutherland worked as a barmaid. Her body ends up being found under an overpass hidden in some weeds along County Route 89. Sutherland was found fully clothed, although her wrists were bound with a pair of pantyhose, which had also been tied around her neck. Police discovered that Linda had been beaten pretty brutally, and that there were shotgun pellets in her shoulder. What led police to Harry Lanham was a witness came forward stating that they had seen Sutherland in a parking lot talking to two men driving in a red tow truck, which is eventually tied back to Lanham. And now we get the typical story. Lanham ends up saying that, yes, he was there, he was involved in it. However, it was his friend, Nopa, who actually committed the murder. When police bring Nopa in, Nopa then turns around and says, well, he was there for it. It was actually Larry that committed the murder. Nopa said during his interrogation by police, quote, Harry and I both knew what was going to happen, but we didn't talk about it. We both knew that we were going to kill the girl. Now, both of these men are going to end up being convicted for this murder in November of 1972, with Nopa receiving 50 years and Larry ending up with 25. However, Larry can't seem to keep his mouth shut. After his conviction, while he's awaiting transportation to arrive to bring him to the prison where he is to serve out his sentence, he starts talking to the jailers and starts making some claims that, while I don't believe all of them, may be true to some respect. He starts telling the police that he and Nopa had in fact killed many of the missing young women who had been discovered in the Galveston area. We know that police from all of the affected jurisdictions arrive at the jail to question Larry. However, police have never officially released any of the things that he has said, beyond the fact that Larry is supposed to have confessed to killing a 22-year-old woman by the name of Pamela Hubner, who was a housewife that had last been seen on June 9th, 1971, though to date, no remains have ever been found. Gloria Ann Gonzalez, who's one of the young women we have been talking about, she was the 19-year-old who disappeared outside of her apartment and whose body was found nearby Colette Wilson, who supposedly Larry also confessed to having raped and murdered. There was such a strong belief in the idea that Larry and his homicidal partner had possibly committed these crimes that Colette's father, the dentist who identified her teeth, actually went to the jail and interviewed Larry himself. Sources close to Tom Wilson stated that While he never spoke of what Larry told him, he left the jail feeling disgusted, as though he had been misled, and that he did not believe any of the things that Larry had told him. With one of his family members saying, quote, "Tom said that man wasn't the one who killed Colette. He wasn't the one." The last known victim that Larry is supposed to have confessed to murdering is Adele Gypsy Crabtree, who was a 16-year-old who went missing around November 2nd, 1971. She was found murdered in Montgomery County. Some consider Larry and Anthony as suspects in all of these cases. However, the likelihood that either of them did these crimes, in my opinion, is very low. We will, unfortunately, almost certainly never really know the answer, as in December of 1972, Larry ends up being shot by a police officer. There are varying stories concerning what happened. Some state that he was wielding a knife while in jail, attempting to escape, and the officers shot him. Others that he started a fight inside of the jail, and that in the course of attempting to break it up, this officer shot him. Regardless of which version of events is actually true, the fact remains that he ends up dying before the stories that he put out there could be confirmed or dismissed. I personally don't believe that either of these two men were responsible for any of the further killings that Larry attempted to lay claim to. I think more likely than not, it was a case wherein he was convicted of one murder, going away to a Texas prison for 25 years. Texas prisons are notoriously rough, and was looking to get some form of preferential treatment or to make himself appear badder to the other inmates that he was going to be housed with in an effort to dissuade others from causing him any problems. As the reality is, the crime that he was convicted of, beyond the fact that it's the abduction of a young woman, bears no resemblance in any form to the other crimes which we have been discussing. In terms of victimology, i.e. age range, in terms of where the victim's remains were discovered, and the condition of said remains. Now, before this particular drama with Larry and Nopa ends up playing out, however, another man from Webster, Texas, was brought to the attention of the Webster Police Department. And that man's name is Michael Lloyd Self. Self was described as a slow individual that was easily led by others. Many described him as non-aggressive, a mama's boy, who worked at a local gas station that was targeted by the police in an attempt to clear the Renee Johnson and Sharon Shaw murders from the books. What ends up happening is, in May of 1972, a man by the name of Glenn Price, who worked as a Galveston City Councilman, contacted the sheriff in Webster, Texas, and told them that they should take a look into Michael Self. We know that officers arrived at the gas station, spoke with Self for a period of time, and that the following day he voluntarily went to the police station. What happened next is a matter of conjecture. Police stated that Self confessed to having committed the murders, writing out a detailed confession to the police, while others, those who believe that Michael Self was railroaded into this crime, believe the statements that Self later gave, wherein he said that the police chief, a man by the name of Donald Morris, held Self in confinement for hours on end, informing him that he was not going to be allowed to leave until he made a full confession, that Morris had held him against the wall, beaten him with a nightstick, as well as taunted Self with his pistol, threatening to kill the man if he did not come clean and admit to having killed Renee and Sharon. People who believe Self's version of events point to the fact that there were numerous inconsistencies in his written confession, such as the fact that Self stated in this confession that he had dumped the bodies of Shaw and Johnson in El Lago, which is roughly 20 miles, give or take, from where both girls' remains were eventually discovered, and that he had strangled both victims to death. Those who believe in Self's innocence point to the fact that because of the advanced stage of decomposition, if you'll remember, Renee and Sharon were both found skeletonized in pieces, no cause of death could be definitively listed. Now, on June 23rd of 1972, Self gives a oral confession to the police that not only conflicts with the known facts of the case, but also conflicts with the confession that he had given 3 days prior. Now, this isn't a case like Jesse Miss Kelly from the West Memphis 3. You listen to this show, you already know my views on those particular individuals and on their obvious guilt. Jesse Miss Kelly gave multiple confessions, at least 5 or 6, with the last few being seen as the truth of the matter as far as law enforcement as well as many of the victims' family are concerned. Miss Kelly, in his case, stated that the earlier confessions, he intentionally gave misleading information to law enforcement officials in an effort to see just how much they knew and to see if he could trick them. Whatever you believe concerning that particular case, if you look at the bare bones facts of what Miss Kelly said, things like location of the attack, time of day and night, what was used against the victims, those kinds of things were fairly consistent throughout all of his confessions. However, in Michael Self's oral confession, he talked about picking the two girls up outside of a Sizzler, driven to El Lago, which is roughly 34.8 miles from where the girls were last seen in Galveston, where they had eaten at a Jack in a Box. Now, according to this confession, they drove for a while until Self pulled to a secluded area, at which point he hit both girls over the head with a Coca-Cola bottle, stripped their clothing off of them, and threw them out onto the highway. After which, he strangled them and dumped their bodies in a culvert on Chaudet Road. You can already hear the discrepancies of this confession, not only from the last confession, but also from the known facts of Johnson and Shaw's case. So a lot of the information we're going to discuss here comes from those who knew both girls. Renee Johnson's grandfather a city councilman. The murder of his granddaughter apparently hit him extremely hard, so he and his allies in the Webster City Council decided to gut the entire police department and put in charge those who they saw as being capable of solving these crimes. Well, Michael Self was known to hang around the fire department, but also to hang around the police department. Many who knew him said that he was a police buff, and he liked talking with the officers about the various crimes that had been committed in the area, which is not a crime and actually is not that unusual, particularly when you take into account that Michael Self was diagnosed with having some form of brain injury right around the time he was in the fifth grade, which caused him difficulty in speaking, understanding things that were said to him, etc. So now the story that has been told by those who knew Johnson and Shaw is that Johnson's grandfather, unhappy with the job being done to find his granddaughter's killer, fires the chief of police and hires a Texas state trooper named Donald Ray Morris and his partner, Tommy Lee Deal, installing them as chief of police and assistant chief of police on May 20th of 1972, pretty much charged solely with getting a conviction for Renee Johnson's murder. Now, there's a lot of different versions of how Michael Self came to the attention of police. Some point to the fact that, being the way that he was, Michael Self talked about the girl's murders with law enforcement, probably in an effort to try and understand them. Although, according to some sources, police took this as, you know, latent guilt leaking out of him. Others state that Self was being investigated for possibly having stolen gas from the fire chief's car, while a third train of thought is that the new chief of police did not like Michael Self because he had been friends with the former chief of police. In any event, Donald Ray Morris, who comes across in every interview I've seen with or read of him like a complete asshole, leaned really hard on Michael Self, stating in open court that Self was frightened of him and that later he was scared to death of him because of what he could do to him. This gives you an idea of the type of individual we're dealing with, you know, micropenis syndrome, one of those guys who gets into a position of authority and thinks he's the baddest motherfucker walking the planet and everybody better tread carefully around them because don't you know who I am and what I can do to your life. Now, decades later in depositions, officers who worked for the Webster Police Department would state that they witnessed Morris shouting at a handcuffed Self, who cowered and began to cry, slamming him against the wall, hitting him with his nightstick, etc. One of these officers would later state under deposition that he witnessed Michael Self dictate to Morris what to write into the confession, and that it was apparent to him, given the violence that he had incurred, that Michael Self was absolutely terrified. In June of 72, Michael Self is arrested. However, he's not charged with both girls' murders. Instead, he is charged with the murder of Sharon Shaw. This is a fairly common tactic in cases where there are multiple murders, where a district attorney will hold back on some of the charges in the event that they don't get the desired outcome at trial, i.e., the individual is found not guilty, or they don't get the death penalty, which is obviously what they're going to be seeking in Texas. A man by the name of Dewey Meadows ends up being appointed to represent Self. Meadows had worked for the Galveston County Prosecution's Office. And according to Meadows, on the day that he's assigned, the day that Self ends up giving the confession, he contacted the Webster Police Department and is told that he cannot talk to his client when Meadows identifies himself and informs officers that they're to stop speaking with Self until he is present. The police department ignores him, and Self is continued to be interrogated. By the time that Meadows is able to meet with his client, Self has already signed a confession. Upon talking with Michael Self, Meadows states that he was told that he had never even met the girls and was not guilty of it. When pressed as to why he had signed this confession, Self told Meadows that he was terrified that the chief of police was going to kill him. Self then recounts a story wherein Morris pulled out his service revolver, removed bullets from it, and told Self that there was one bullet left in the chamber, at which point he spins the chamber and then places the gun to Self's head, playing Russian roulette with the man that he has interrogated. He also shows him red welts on his abdomen from where he said that Morris had struck him with his nightclub. According to Meadows, Michael Self said, quote unquote, "I think that man's crazy." The day after Michael Self's arrest, the story is all over the Webster newspapers, with Chief Morris saying that his hard work and determination had solved this case, and that it was his hard work that may help the other departments solve their open murder cases. Now, as he's awaiting trial, numerous members of the Texas Rangers, as well as deputies and police officers from other jurisdictions where these crimes have occurred, visit Michael Self in his jail cell. However, all of them leave feeling that Michael Self has had nothing to do with any of the crimes. This was further bolstered by the fact that Michael Self is given a polygraph examination 2 days after his confession, which he fails, with the conclusion being that the man who had confessed to the murders was not responsible for these crimes. The defense started looking at the various confessions that Michael Self is supposed to have given, and they noted all of the glaring inconsistencies, what we discussed earlier, but also that Self stated he picked up one of the girls at her home, not in downtown Galveston. His timeline was also found to be fraudulent, as Michael Self stated during these various confessions that all of the activities that he was confessing to had occurred late in the afternoon or early evening. We know that this is not the case, as during the period of time that Michael Self said that all of this happened, the parents of both Renee Johnson and Sharon Shaw had already reported their daughters missing. Not even the physical evidence supported things that Self stated. In his second confession, he stated that he had beaten both girls unconscious with a Coke bottle. However, medical examiners were unable to find any sort of fractures present in either of the girls' skulls. Moreover, they could find no evidence to indicate that Self's described manner of killing, strangulation, had indeed occurred. Then there's the fact of the clothing. Self stated that he had thrown the girls' clothing out while he was driving down the freeway with their dead bodies in the car. We've already discussed that the clothing that both Renee and Sharon were wearing was actually discovered not far from where both girls' remains had been located. Because of this, Michael Self ends up being interrogated yet again, without notifying his lawyer of this, and it's at this point that Self signs a second confession, which more closely resembles the known facts of the case. According to Self's lawyer, Dewey Metals, quote, "The police questioned Mike even though I said they couldn't. He signed confessions and then told me and his mother that he didn't kill the girls." When questioned as to why he had signed this second confession, Mike informs Meadows that the police told him that if he does what they want, they will let him see his mother. Pictures would later emerge showing Michael Self out in Taylor Bayou, ostensibly pointing to investigators where the girls' bodies had been left, although, according to both Meadows and Michael Self, officers brought him out there and instructed him where to look. Michael Self ends up going on trial on May 7th, 1973. Because of the Supreme Court ruling in Furman v. Georgia the previous year, the death penalty is not on the table. Obviously, his lawyer is going to file motions to have the confessions barred from the trial. Self ends up taking the stand during this closed to the public and the jury portion of the trial, where he recounts how he had been threatened, intimidated, and beaten by Webster police in order to obtain the confessions. A friend of Michael Self's took the stand on Self's behalf, stating that he had had run-ins with the new chief of police, and that it was apparent to him that Morris was out to get Self. However, despite all of this, the confessions are allowed into trial. At trial, the prosecution gives the jury copies of Michael Self's second confession, photographs of the girl's remains, as well as the photographs of Michael Self at the crime scene pointing to various locations. They also presented a witness who said that he thought he saw Michael Self talking to both Renee and Sharon at the gas station where Michael worked, as well as various law enforcement officials, including Chief Morris, who took the stand and basically told the version of events that they felt the jury needed to hear. When the defense presented its case to the court, Michael Self was called, and he again reiterated the story that he had told previously to both his lawyer, his mother, as well as to the judge in private chambers. On rebuttal, Morris denied all of the things that Self said, stating that everything Michael Self had told the police had been voluntary and there had been no form of coercion. On September 18th, 1974, Michael Self is found guilty of the murder of Sharon Shaw and is sentenced to life imprisonment. Despite numerous appeals, Self ends up dying in prison of cancer in 2000. But the story involving all of this is not over. The next episode, we're going to get back into the murderers proper, but I feel it's only just that we continue looking at the story of Michael Self and the men who got him convicted. And I hope that you are prepared, as this is some shit right out of a Hollywood movie. Not long after the conviction of Michael Self, Don Morris ends up resigning from his position as the Webster Chief of Police and returning to the Texas Department of Public Safety as a trooper. About a year after this, Tommy Deal, his former partner as a Texas State Trooper and the Chief of Police in Webster, also ends up leaving the department. In September of 1975, in a town called Caddo Mills, which is northeast of Dallas, the State National Bank was robbed. Now, this isn't a normal small town. This is a small town in Texas. And people show up en masse, armed, in time to see both of the robbers fleeing the bank, holding the teller, who also happens to be the daughter of the bank president, hostage. 25 members of the town of Caddo Mills give pursuit. Outside of the town limits, the car ends up coming to a halt, and the bandits attempt to take off. At which point, the members of Caddo Mills surround them with guns. With no other option, these men are forced to surrender. One of them turns out to be Tommy Deal, the former chief of police and state trooper in Webster, Texas. The other is another former state trooper. The police start investigating these two men and learn that they are part of a ring that has been robbing banks throughout the area as far back as 1972. In fact, this ring was active prior to and during the interrogation of Michael Self. Furthermore, it is uncovered that the head of this ring is none other than former Webster Chief of Police Don Morris. Don Morris ends up being sentenced to 55 years in federal prison, while his co-conspirators end up getting 30 years apiece. Now, the really interesting and fucked up thing in all of this is the fact that despite their arrest and conviction on federal charges, when Michael Self appealed to the Supreme Court in 1992 or 3, Don Morris was allowed to testify and stated that he had in fact leaned on Self extremely hard, stating, quote, "I told Mike before he ever confessed that I was going to arrest him for murder, you know, of the girls." Despite all of this, the Supreme Court rejected Mike Self's appeals. Pretty much no one connected with this case, even the prosecutors who had been assigned by the state of Texas during the various appeals processes, believed that Michael Self was guilty of these murders, and it felt instead that he had been bullied and coerced into the situation by corrupt law enforcement officials. However, the conviction was left to stand, and as of today, Michael Self, since deceased 25 years ago, is still seen as a convicted murderer. We are going to end the episode at this point, my D&Ders. I honestly hope that you have enjoyed this second look at the Texas killing fields, and when we come back next week, we are going to continue on looking at this series of largely unsolved murders, which after the spate of killings in 1971 pretty much goes quiet for a few years until a new string of murders appears. Until next time, stay morbid.